Today, a special episode of Vox Talks Economics on economic warfare. Well, welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips, and every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. If states are to pursue economic warfare against Russia, what policies are lawful, what would be politically feasible, and what would be economically effective? To find out, we need to ask someone who's both a politician and an economist, and that's Luis Garicano, member of the European Parliament and CEPR Fellow. Luis, welcome back to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, Tim. It's really great to be here again. Thank you very much.
Luis, economic sanctions. Remember in 2008 over Georgia and 2014 over Crimea, they've often been dismissed as too slow, too easy to get around, and so useless as a way to fight a war. What's changed?
I think that in the past, we have been looking to do sanctions that are painless. We've been looking for the eternal free lunch. Our audience will know what I mean.
Yeah.
Politicians don't want to inflict any cost on their voters. So they say, well, we'll do this thing that is magic and inflicts only cost on the other side. Mm. Of course, those things don't tend to work. I think the difference now is that the behavior of Putin has been so brutal and the reaction of the Ukrainians so heroic that it has served to mobilize the minds of people to actually do some serious damage, to put in place some sanctions that are going to hurt. I mean, we are still reserving the energy tools, which we will talk about probably later, but particularly on the financial sector, the effort to devastate the financial sector is a significant step up from what has been done in the past.
The first initiative in that was to disconnect Russia from the SWIFT network. Why is SWIFT so important to the Russian economy?
SWIFT is the international messaging system that helps banks undertake payments. And without being connected to a messaging system, you cannot send messages, so you cannot send payments. The idea is that if we disconnected the Russian banks and they weren't able to get the cash and to pay the cash, then the economy would come down swiftly, if you allow me. The problem, of course, is that we haven't really disconnected all of the banks. What we have done is disconnect 7 key banks, but we have left in place 2 banks, the largest bank in Russia, Sberbank, and the bank that is related to Gazprom Bank. And the purpose has been to allow for energy payments. Now, since the bulk of the payments we worry about have to do with energy, I don't think the SWIFT sanctions are going to have the impact that we were wanting them to have. There are other sanctions, such as the ones on the central bank reserves, that are going to have a huge impact. But sadly, the SWIFT sanctions are not sufficient, because at the end of the day, what Russia has in terms of its main source of foreign currency payments and receipts are energy related.
So if the goal is to eject Russia from the financial system, 7 entities is not enough and SWIFT alone is not enough?
I would phrase the goal in the following way. Mm-hmm. If you go for slow burning, heavy sanctions, like the ones that we have put on the industry, on the aircraft, etc., you're going to cripple Russia's economy. It's going to work, but it's going to take years. It's going to leave Putin in place. Mm-hmm. So the goal, in my opinion, has to be to produce such a brutal impact on Russia that cannot actually pay its pensions, cannot pay its soldiers, cannot pay its current expenses, that it literally, the economy collapses. In order to do that, what you would really want to do is to make the financial system collapse. And there is one measure that we have taken that does go in that direction, which is the exclusion of the Central Bank of Russia, the block on the Central Bank of Russia from being able to access its foreign reserves. Central banks, like everybody else, like companies and like us, have their cash, in this case, their reserves, in the form of deposits in other banks. They had actually accumulated a massive stash of cash, $650 billion, in Central Bank of Japan, in the Eurozone central banks, in England, in the US, in the New York, in the Federal Reserve. And these sanctions have included something that I don't think anybody expected as far as recently as last Saturday, which is to say, Mr. Central Bank of Russia, you have all this money deposited, but you can't touch it. It's frozen.
But I thought around this, Luis, though, that Russia had diversified its reserves. It was holding more gold, more Chinese currency.
It is correct. Of the 650 billion, there is 135 billion in gold, and there are 85 billion in Chinese securities. So there is at least 220 billion that you're not going to be able to touch. Mm-hmm. And they have a little bit on the IMF, and then they have some cash. So all of this together means that maybe you're touching only 60, 70% of what you could have. Of course, the gold cannot be used. The Central Bank of Russia will have to go around selling gold, and it's not clear which bank is going to be willing to buy this gold. Because it will fall under some really serious US and European retaliation. So the gold is not clear if it can help them. The yuan reserves, the renminbi reserves, the reserves in Chinese currency are going to be more feasible to use to cushion this. But the main thing that really stops these sanctions from working, again, we said it with SWIFT, but it's going to happen again with the central bank reserves, is going to be the enormous amount of payments that we are giving to Russia in the form of payments for energy every day. Mm. Just Europe and just on gas, we're sending right now 700 million euros per day. If you add all the energy payments, Russia is getting around 1.5 billion in hard cash per day. With that money, a country that has a current account surplus, so it doesn't need to borrow on an everyday basis. With that money, it can pay its pensioners, it can pay its debt, and it can pay its army. So even if we are not allowing the central bank to touch its reserves, it's creating new reserves every day. What the Central Bank of Russia did is it told Gazprom and the rest of the energy exporters, look, you are forced, you are obliged to convert 80% of the money you get at any time into rubles. Mm-hmm. So they immediately have to transfer the cash, the hard cash they're getting, this 1.5 billion per day, into rubles. And that means the ruble demand continues to be important. And that means people who are trying to get out of rubles in Russia find dollars. And that means that the ruble doesn't collapse. So our sanctions are very heavy, but they have a big black hole in the middle, which is energy. Europe and the US are scared of really doing without Russian gas because they think, well, the European economy, particularly Germany and Italy and some other countries, are not going to be able to do without that gas.
Yes, let's talk about that because, as you say, that money is vital to the Russian economy at the moment. The gas is vital to Germany, Italy, Baltic states. Are you saying that they should disconnect from Russian gas?
My hope would be that we will do that as soon as possible, today better than tomorrow. And I think that by keeping this kind of heavy but not immediately emergency producing sanctions in place, we're going to maximize the pain to the Russian people. They're going to take months in an economy which is going to become devastated. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to make the economy inoperable. It's going to continue to run. So we maximize, we get the war to be lengthy, we get the pain to the Russians to be long. And on the other hand, we also incur lots of costs. I would say the sharp pain of like, we don't a single euro of cash for gas starting tomorrow, which really brings pensioners, military, etc. to the street because you cannot pay the military salaries and because there is a real collapse of the financial system, is much more painful for us in the short run, but it's likely to last shorter and it's likely to really produce a reaction. The question, of course, is can we do without this energy? And my view, and I think the view of the International Energy Agency, is that yes, we can live without that energy. It will be without that gas. It will be hard, but we can do it.
How do you do that? Because I would have thought energy prices would spike. Will we have enough gas? What's the solution to this?
You're right that energy prices spike, and some people are worried that they would say, well, look, if energy prices spike, then Russia is going to get a lot of money selling their oil. So there is a very big difference between oil and gas. Mm-hmm. Gas sales are infrastructure dependent. In order to sell your gas, you need pipes. And so Russia cannot sell the gas to Europe. It's going to eat up the gas. It cannot send it to China through another pipe because that's already saturated. There is no capacity to export the gas. So if we stop buying the gas, then how do we replace it? We replace it with LNG. There's a lot of unused capacity to liquefy gas in Europe and to actually transform the gas in ways that we can transport it. For example, Spain, which has all this energy capacity, we could transport it to Germany to put in a storage for the winter. So we have LNG, we can reduce consumption, and we should definitely continue using nuclear energy. As you know, Germany was supposed to close their last nuclear plants this year. Mm. Oil is a different story. Oil is hard to hit them with oil in the sense that oil is something which is easier to divert. There is an idea by Harvard economist, which is Ricardo Hausmann, who says, look, what you need to do is to put a big tax on oil. Mm. That's going to reduce utilization, is going to hit Russia, and is not going to force us to kind of go cold turkey on it. So we're still discussing how we wean ourselves of Russian energy. My view is that there are different possibilities on how we do it, but that we need to do it. There is no question about it.
So I want to talk to you about two groups of people in Russia. First of all, the ordinary people. As you say, if you go hard on these sanctions, isn't it going to affect mostly them?
Yes, it's going to inflict some collateral damage. There's no question about it. And if you want to collapse the Russian economy, then people are going to suffer. Mm-hmm. The problem is that we are seeing an open warfare in Europe for the first time in many years. Really a big invasion with tanks, the worst aggression that we have seen in 70 years. And we need to break the coalition that supports Putin, which are some people who like stability, the military and the security services and the oligarchs. We need to be able to show people that it doesn't pay. We need to eliminate the political support for Putin, and that has costs. What you cannot do is, again, there is no free lunch for Mars, and there is no free lunch for them. If they are invading a country, they have to incur a cost. I'm sorry for that, because that's going to create a lot of need in many places in Russia, but I think it's inevitable if we want to try to protect Ukrainians.
And the other group I want to talk about, you mentioned them just then, the oligarchs, the 0.01%. It makes news when we seize their yachts and they have to sell their football teams. Does that really make any difference when it comes to winning a war?
It has already made a difference, and it will make a difference. Russia has something very unusual, which Gabriel Zucman and co-authors have identified in a series of papers. Two really interesting points that people have to remember. First, in very few countries, as in Russia, do a very small group of people control such a huge share of wealth. Mm. Probably in that respect, the Russian economy is the most unequal in the world. But second, and this is something that increases the vulnerability, in very few countries, if any, so much of that wealth is held offshore. Mm-hmm. The oligarchs have been scared of Putin as well, even though they're allied with him. And they have been keeping the money in fiscal havens in areas controlled by the UK, the Crown territories, etc., in areas controlled by the US, and in areas controlled by Europe, such as Monaco and Luxembourg and Cyprus and all these other places. By imposing heavy sanctions on the ability of these people to move their wealth. But not only that, there are lists that we are updating every day right now. The people in those lists will have travel bans, they will have their wealth and their physical assets blocked, and in some cases they will have this wealth seized. Now, why is this so important? Because this is the core group of people who have benefited from the Putin regime, and this is the core group of people who have the possibility to do something about it. Our strategy right now is, if you put together discontent among the voters and the people who have soldiers in the front with discontent among the army who's seen their best units being burnt in Ukraine in a crazy war, and you add discontent among the elites and the rich people who send their kids to English schools and who have the jets and enjoy the global lifestyle and now not going to enjoy that ever again. Mm-hmm. If you put those three things together, I would think that Putin should be coming under very, very heavy pressure.
If you seize the assets of that group, then on what legal grounds do you do it? How do you define someone who is vulnerable to a seizure? What do you seize?
Yeah, this is a great point, right? To what extent you're breaching national laws, mm-hmm. and to what extent you're breaching international law. From the international law perspective, the truth is that there is a huge breach of international law. There's a state that carries a war of aggression, and it is accepted that states can react with countermeasures to these actions. So to the extent that there is international wrongful action, the state is injured, which I think it's accepted that all the states right now are injured because it's a war of aggression. To the extent that it's proportional, you can take countermeasures to counter this breach of international law. So I think that from the international law perspective, you are safe. From the national law perspective, I think it's going to depend on the countries. In many countries in Europe, you can freeze the assets of people who have been involved with things like money laundering or in criminal activity or assets that have to do with the results of criminal activity. Now, of course, from freezing them to taking them and expropriating them, there is a step. And that second step generally needs a criminal court to say this particular person is linked to this particular criminal activity. I would say, if you think of Nuremberg, and there were these big debates about waging war, conspiracy to wage war, preparations to wage war, there were key moments where Hitler had met with certain people and made this decision. In the case of Russia, this we have seen on TV. The Security Council was actually forced by Putin to actually come on TV and declare their view on this. So we have evidence of a set of really influential, really important people who have actually participated in making this decision. And I think in all those cases, it will be pretty straightforward to link them to the criminal activity. In other cases, it will be harder. But I think that from an international law perspective, this is going to be fine. And from national law, to the extent that seizures are part of the arsenal of money laundering, etc., I think it will be also justified by the way these decisions were made.
So let me finish with a European question then. If these sanctions are going to bite, as you say, there will be some suffering for the European people as well. But that burden is going to fall unequally on different countries. How will Europe's fiscal framework cope with that?
Europe needs to assume this cost collectively. We shouldn't deal with them from a monetary policy perspective because we're going to end up with a lot of inflation. Europe needs to deal with refugee costs, deal with defense expenditures, which are going to be higher, and deal with energy, both protecting people from the energy costs, as you were pointing out, Tim, but also rejigging all the energy infrastructure to allow to change from gas from Russia to LNG, etc. All of those are investments that I think should be European-wide. I think those are all investments that we should make as Europeans. And I would hope that in the same way as Europe mutualized these costs when we were talking about the previous big shock we had, which was the pandemic, I would hope that that's what we will do now, that we will have a big European fund that will allow us to deal with this gigantic supply shock that is a war and that is the massive sanctions that we are taking already.
Luis Garicano, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Well, we're here every week, so please subscribe. And whatever type of economics you like, you'll find there is a Vox Talk waiting for you.